Okay, here we go. Sharing my screen. We are learning Megillas Esther. Okay, the beginning. First parak of Megillas Esther, first few psukim of Megillas Esther. This is going to be a lot of thought questions, both working through the Malbim's parish of the first few psukim and also the so what factor, right? Oops, didn't mean to do that. Though, like, where, what we could learn from it. Okay, so we're going to learn the first 8 psukim and then take that in mind and see where the Malbim goes with it and what he's explaining, what dimension of Megillas Esther he's explaining to us, and again, what we can learn from it specifically about Purim and about ourselves and our Avodas Hashem. I'm not translating it. You could read the English if you want. Otherwise, most of us are familiar with this. Bahar oso es osher kavod malchuso ve'ase kartivaras kedulaso yamim rabim shmoni ma'as yom uvimlos hayamim ha'ela asa hamelech l'chol ha'am hanimtzayim b'shushan habira lemigadol v'yad katan mishte shivas yamim v'chatzar ginas bisan hamelech chur karbaso techilas achuz b'chavli boots v'argaman. Okay, we're actually gonna skip this. Just a description of the kinds of things that they had at the party. V'hashkos b'chlei zahav v'cheli mechelim shonim v'yain malchus karav rav ki yad hamelech. Okay, Vashtiya kedas inones ki chen yisad hamelech al rav beiso la'asos kirton is ve'ish v'gam Vashtiya malka asda mishdan hashim beis malchus asher l'melech achashverosh. Okay, just getting the first 9 psukim. So that's the introduction to hi Bracha Cohen. That's the introduction to Megillas Esther. So the Malbim goes here and he says we have to understand the context under which Megillas Esther is taking place in order to really understand Megillas Esther and to really have a deep understanding of Megillas Esther. So he goes and he launches in over here. Okay, we're going to work through this ourselves, and I'm going to ask you to gather evidence from Megillas Esther, from those first 9 psukim or any other parts of Megillas Esther that you might know by heart. So again, you might find it useful to log into Safaria yourself. Like, so he says this. Okay, I'm going to start reading to the Malbim, and we're going to do most of it ourselves before it goes. Leva'er ha-parsha hazos. Tzarech anu lahakdim hakdama achas. Before we get into this whole Megillah, we have to do a little introduction, and we have to talk about monarchy. Hine ha-malchus ha-melech b'yamim ha-kadmonim ha-memshalos ha-mitzrim ha-kazdim ha-parsim ha-madayim ha-isa al-achas mishtei drachim. Someone became a king, basically in the olden days. Kingship, monarchy happened in one of 2 circumstances. So you guys tell me, what are the 2 circumstances under which someone would become king?
Inherited,
good.
Anointed,
okay, that's kind of inherited, no? What do you mean by that?
We think of like David versus Shaul, they weren't related, they didn't inherit it, but they were anointed.
Okay, good. So some indication that this person, some collective...
also conquered.
Good. Thank you, Bracha. Good. Okay, so those are the 2 ways. The difference between those 2, right, is some collective... national consensus that this person should be king, right? Whether or not that is inherited, as Batsheva said, anointed, as Ayelet said, right? Or somehow, or elected as a monarch, let's say, if not, election maybe is a little bit of a too democratic modern term to use, right? But some agreement amongst the people that this person should be king, divine right, whatever it is. Or like Bracha Cohen says, right? Kingship by force. Kingship by which you conquer an area and you become king of that area. So like Ayala said, Shaul and David and most of the kings of Judah and Israel are anointed kings or inherited kings. I would say all of them, let's say, right? Yehu comes to mind, right? Yehu basically who did a coup d'etat against the lineage of the kings of Israel and took over. I don't remember who it was from. Achav? Not sure. Ayala, do you know? No? Or conquered kings. I remember my grandfather got an honorary doctorate from the University of Liège in Belgium when I was in 11th grade. And I went with my mom to Belgium to watch him get his honorary doctorate. And I went to like all of these fantastic museums in Belgium and Denmark at the time. And I remember asking my mother, like, which side were the Belgians on in World War II? Right? My actual question is being, are they the good guys or the bad guys? Right? Do we like these people or not? Which side was Belgium on in World War II? My mom looked at me and she said, well, they were conquered by the Germans. And I remember being like, wow, it was just such like a moment where I was like, they were conquered by the Germans. Meaning, I don't know, were they good guys or bad guys? I mean, they were on the Axis, but they were on the Axis because they were conquered by force by the Germans. And, like, we as Americans don't understand that the nationality gets overtaken at some point by, at some times by a conqueror. Okay, good. So what is the name to, okay. So Malim's going to tell us what he feels is the essential difference between these two things. Okay, what's the essential difference between somebody who is elected, so to speak, or by national consensus becomes king, and somebody by force who becomes king? Hamolach ayde b'chiras am, hiskimu al isha chad, lahamlichol aleihem. Okay. Mamlacha mugbeles. He calls it a boundaried kingship. A kingship with boundaries is the one who gets elected by national consent. V'hu shemishareis hamelech al ha'am haisa la gevul yadua. It has known boundaries, and these could differentiate themselves by culture, but there's a certain tacit agreement between the king and the people of how powerful the king is, right? How much is rightful for him to tax them, which laws he has to keep even as the king, right? What he is or isn't allowed to do, who are his allies, who aren't his allies. He's bounded by some sort of affiliation with the general public. Right? There's a tacit agreement of how much power he has and how much power he doesn't have. Mamlecha bilti mugbelas, this is his other word, unbounded kingship, is a king who comes in and conquers. Because why? Shehu sheha melech haya lo reshus lasos kechavto. This king who comes in and conquers, he doesn't have to abide by any pre-existing rules, right? He has no tacit agreement between him and the people. He's allowed to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, right? And there's no agreement that between him and the nation that he just overtook. He could change any of the laws. He could elect any new laws that he wants, right? We're not talking about anarchy. We're not talking about something that doesn't have laws, but he doesn't feel himself bound to the existing laws that existed before him. And he's allowed to make whatever laws he wants afterwards, once he is king. Because he is the law, right? His word is the law. His word is what is important here. He's not bound by anything else. Right, so Malbim calls that an unbounded kingship versus a bounded kingship. And then Malbim talks about five, again, this is very like how Malbim methodically works through things. He talks about five, like nafkaminas, five practical differences between these two types of kings. So how many can we think about here? So you have a king who's elected by the people, or whatever, appointed by the king, by the people, or inherits a kingship that is in agreement with the people's understanding of how he should inherit the kingship. Or you have like a conqueror who comes in and takes over a nation. What are the five differences between those two kinds of kings? You don't have to say five. Say any of them. What are practical differences between those kinds of kings?
A respected leader versus not a respected leader.
A respected leader? Good. Meaning what, Javi?
Meaning you don't have like the liking of the people if you're someone who comes in and just takes over.
Good. Okay, good. So you don't have the liking of the people, and what else do you not have if you're somebody who comes in and takes over? Good. Right? So Javi's pointing out
that. Meaning either, like in America, you're an American, you can run for president. So that same thing, like if you're from Rome and you're the Roman king versus Greece comes over and takes over Rome. So you live somewhere else, you govern different people. Like you're not one with the people you're governing.
Awesome. Good. Amazing. Good. Javi and Ayala, good. Right, the first and most essential thing that's really going to underline the five things that he's pointing out is that there's a certain kinship, belonging, and identity of the king who gets elected as part of his people, both in their relationship with him and his relationship with them, which is where he goes and defines these five. But what you guys just pointed out is the underlying essential difference is whether or not he has a affiliation, like a deep affiliation with the people that he's ruling or not. Good. So what are some of those things that are different? Right? Go deeper. You guys are on it, meaning you have the essential difference, but how would that practically play out? Should I give you one example? Let's read his first example and then you try to think of more. He says this. Hamulich mamlacha mugbeles, a bounded king, right, an elected. I'm gonna use the word anointed or elected king, but I don't mean that they actually were, you know, democratically elected. Hamulich mamlacha mugbeles, hamelach haya shomer hamedina. He also has a responsibility towards them, right? He cares about this country. This is his country, right? It's his people. He wants them to do well. Right? He keeps their laws, but he also fights their wars for them, and he tries to protect them, and he tries to make sure that they're safe, and he tries to make sure that they're prospering. I lost my place. Sorry. V'hei meshubadim lo l'dvarim hatzurichim l'tzorech haklal. Right? They agree to serve him in service that is needed for everybody. They'll fight in his war. If he, you know, when he goes out to war, they'll come and they'll get drafted into the army. They'll give him a certain amount of taxes of their food and of, right, kimo hamas v'chaduma, right? They'll give him taxes because it's agreed upon that what he's doing with the taxes is sustaining that country, is taking care of them. Aval hamolech mamlecha bilti mugbeles, right? But the unbounded king, the king who comes in by conquest, v'chazaka, hamadina haisa meshubedes alav, right? Everybody is just his servant. Right, everybody is just totally enslaved to him. It's as if they're all his servants, they're all his slaves. And he does whatever he wants with them without any responsibility towards them. Just like a master would do with his slaves and his livestock and his possessions. Right, so a bounded king has some sort of responsibility in that camaraderie, not only that the people respect him, exactly like we're saying, Chavi, right? But also that he feels responsible towards them, which I think is also what Ayala was saying. Good. What else is different practically? So one of them is that, you know, the identity of the people vis-a-vis the king. They're Ba'alma, you know what I mean? They're practical examples. They're not like highfalutin examples. What else is going to be different? If you were a visitor to those two kingdoms, what kinds of things would you find the leaders doing differently in those two places? The other ones are about the leader. This one was about the relationship between him and his people, and the other four that he gives are about the leader himself. What would they be doing differently from each other?
I'd assume a focus on one's own like group of people versus like obsession with conquering and going outwards.
Okay, good. So, like, where his focus is, good. He doesn't talk about that, but that makes a lot of sense, right? Are you responsible? Again, you know, Ayala, like, you're such a good... If you were the king, Ayala, you know, this is where you'd be going with it. Like, who are you responsible for? That's where your mind is. You're responsible towards your people, you know? So that's the difference, is that the Mugbelis would be responsible towards his people, and the other one would be always, like, looking outwards to conquest more. Good. Let me give you another one of these, right? The second example is in terms of, like, the finances of the country. What's going to be different in terms of the finances? How they're going to treat the finances of the country?
Shared versus mine.
Good, right? Shared and used, utilitarian, right? The treasury of the country is used to better the country and better the welfare of everybody, and we're going to invest overseas and blah, 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 to see the return so that in 20 years from now, our merchants, blah, 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 right? Versus the treasury is for me. I can do whatever I want. I can use the treasury however I want, right? The finances are for my own, as the conqueror, whatever I want to do with it, whatever, whatever. Good, what else? Okay, I'm going to read it to you and you tell me what he's talking about. Hamelech ha-mamelech ha-mugbeles, a bounded king. Lo haya afshar lo la'asos dover klali. Im lo b'haskama sarai ha'itza. He can't just make a decision that impacts the whole nation without going through some sort of process of seeking advice and needing to, you know, get the input of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Uvim lacha bildi mugbeles, right? But a conqueror, a despot. Haya yochol l'sakein v'laharos l'chol. Hakol levado b'li netila itza urshus klal. But somebody who is a despot, he could do whatever he wants without having to ask advice of anybody. Right? So that's talking about what? His decision-making, right? How he makes decisions that impact the country. Keep going. Harishon. Anyone have any other ideas now that we're talking about it? What else? What else? What else? You guys are like, I don't know, Hannah. We don't live in a monarchy. Stop hounding me about monarchy.
I'm guessing maybe something about justice system.
Good. Good. Bracha, good. Meaning what? What's the difference?
I don't know. It just sounded like it would go next, but maybe... Like, if he's, like, a benevolent or a punitive ruler.
Interesting, right. Like, you're saying, like, their attitudes towards justice. So justice is next. Very good, Bracha. That was, like, a fantastic intuition in terms of Torah. Awesome. So that's what he talks about next, is the justice system. But this is where he goes with it. Sharishon haya nosin tachas datei hamaduna. The first king is also bound by the laws of the of the place, right? Again, like David HaMelech, let's say, right, and other kings, you can't just do whatever you want. You also have to keep the Torah. You also have to keep the Torah that applies to the kings, right? Sometimes there's a different amount. There's a different kinds of laws that apply to the kings, but you have to do the laws that apply to the king. Otherwise, everyone will like rise up and coup d'etat against you, right? You are bound by some sort of tradition or laws of the place. V'lohaya efshar lo la'avor la'avor al datos kvuim. He can't. The king can't stand up against set laws. V'hasheni. Right, but this conqueror kind of king, right? Another one, he's in charge of the justice system. He could decide which ones he wants to keep, he could decide which ones he doesn't want to keep, he could make new ones, he could take out old ones, or he could do whatever he wants. The last one, what's the last thing? Number five, Hamulech Mamlacha Mugbeles, the bounded king, Lohaya Afshar, Lolashanos, Ir Hamalucha, Velikvoa Hamalucha Bamakamacher. And this is like the most detailed thing, but I think it's talking about traditions in general, right? There are certain traditions that are assumed when you take over the king, for if you're in the kingship, if you're anointed or if you inherit it, such as where the capital city is. We saw, again, the politics around this ourselves relatively recently. Rakhaya Tzarech Lishev Alkise Malchus Hamalachim Asher Lefanev, Beir Asher Zachta Lamikadem. Right? You sit in the throne of the same, you sit in the same throne that the same kings all before you had sit in the same city. That's where you are. Aval HaMolech built you Hagbala, but the conquering king, Hayayachol Lashanos Kichatzo, he changes whatever he wants. Hi, Shira. All right, whatever serves him, that's what he does, that's what he changes. Okay, so these are the five ways that bounded kings and unbounded kings differ. Now the Malbim is going to tell us which one Ahasuerus is. Okay, both according to Chazal, but also according to mostly, slash, I don't know, mostly, right? Chazal tell us which one Ahasuerus is, but also we gather evidence that of what Ahasuerus is doing in his first nine psukim, and he continues to do throughout the Megillah. Okay, which of, hi Chana, which of these kinds of kings is Ahasuerus? Is Ahasuerus an inheriting, conquering king? Is Ahasuerus an incoming conquering king? Or is Ahasuerus an inheriting, elected, so to speak, by the will of the people king? And give me evidence of these five things that we expect to see the difference between a conquering king and an inheriting king. Which ones of these is Ahasuerus? What does he show us that he is based on what he does in these first nine psukim, but then also, as we know, throughout the Megillah, because you could bring evidence from wherever you want. But if you're stuck, look in the first nine psukim. Let me go back to it. I'm going to put it on the screen in Hebrew. Whoops. Aleph. Okay. Here we have some of the first times again. Can I make it a smaller font? Let me read it again. V'hi mimei Ahasuerus, hu Ahasuerus, hamolech mehodi baku sheva v'asirin mimei medina. Ahasuerus sits on his throne in Shushan Habira, in Shushan the capital. He makes a party for all of his servants, basically. And he shows them all his riches, his treasury. And how great he is. It was a long party. He makes another party for the ones who are in Shushan specifically. And he shows them all these great things. There's all this, you know, riches and great whatever stuff at the party. And he gives them a lot to drink. And he doesn't require them to do anything. And Vashti also makes herself a party in the house of the king. Okay, slash here, but also other places in Megillas Esther. What do you know from Megillas Esther that you could bring to bear if you were going to argue with me whether or not Ahasuerus was, hi Rachel Brown, a bounded king, an inheriting king, or a conquering king? Again, in parentheses, we're going to talk about like why we think this matters. But let's talk about which one was he. Come on.
I think simply in the first pasuk, we think that he has 127 territories, so we'd assume that he's a conquering king.
Good, awesome, good. Yeah, very good, right? The first thing, it talks about Ahasuerus, and it talks about the fact that he is the ruler of 127 countries. So we are assuming here that maybe he inherited like from Alexander the Great or whatever. Obviously not Alexander the Great because he was before Alexander the Great. Right, but maybe he inherited from some great conquering person his country, but probably not. So we're going to assume that maybe that's evidence that he's a conquering king. Good. What else? What does he do, guys? What does he do in the Megillah that makes us feel like it's one of these or the other ones? Remember what he does with the finances of the country, his relationship with the people of the country, whether or not he follows the traditions of the country, like the capital city, whether or not he feels himself bounded to the laws of the country, and whether or not he makes decisions with advice or without advice. All right, guys, I should have given you homework before this.
Well, in that section, it doesn't seem like he's really asking for advice, and it just seems like he's doing whatever he wants, like throwing a party, capital, like doing whatever he wants as the king because he has the power.
Good. Okay, good. Where else does he do whatever he wants and change laws or not change laws and whatever? All right, we'll have to learn it as we go. Good. So what Malvin does is that he takes apart these next psukim as a series, and he shows how the identity of Ahasuerus is actually interesting and unique. Ahasuerus, he says that Chazal tells us, let's learn it inside. Ready? This is what Chazal tells us about Ahasuerus. Kivi kabalas chachmenu, haya techila hedyu. At first, he was like a regular civilian of Paras Umadai. He was just like a regular civilian guy. And through his wealth and through like ascension up the social ladder, he becomes the king of Paras Umadai, right? This Persia Media place. And he becomes very great in his rulership. Later on, also, Malbim says that he marries Vashti. Vashti was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So he's sort of, it's not that he marries into kingship. He ascends the social ladder. He marries someone who gives him even more legitimacy as an inheritor of Paras Umadai, right? He was ascending the social ladder as a citizen, and he became the king of... He did not inherit, sorry. Is he inherited? One second, Rachel Brown says. Is he inherited? He has no power of his own. Good. So at first, that's who he was, right? At first, when he ascends the social ladder and he marries Vashti, who's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and he becomes king of Paras Umadai, what kind of king is he? Elected, so to speak, right? He's Mugbeles. He's one of them. He's one of Paras Umadai. He ascended the social ladder and he becomes the king. And he marries somebody who gives him the yichlis to be able to claim kingship rightfully, so to speak. And he's good. Okay, so now he's one of theirs. Ad shekavash kol hamdinos. But then Ayala, look what Ayala says, right? Suddenly then he becomes a conquesting king of 127 cities, countries. The Misbar b'yachazaka, with strength. So he was a mugbeles, and then he goes and he conquers 127 cities, and he becomes l'kaba omechoseu l'chavish tachtav b'chashvam sh'amachos megilo b'yerusha al yedei Vashti, right? At first he's someone who became king only because he ascended and because he married Vashti. Umitzad ze haya reishis mamlechaso machus mugbeles. At first he started as a bounded king. V'haya ratza l'hishtarer aleihem b'chazako uv'malacha bilti mugbeles. But he's not happy with that. Exactly like Rachel Brown just said. He wants to become a big dictator. Right? He does not want to be a Melech Mugbeles, again, because he has all these sort of limitations to himself, as we saw. If he's going to be loyal to his own city from whence he was born. So instead, he wants to switch his identity to becoming a conquesting king. Hayazar Iker Hatachbula b'masha hushav hakisei b'shushan. So it says that the reason that we say that this was in Shushan, right? We talk about that. We point out where the capital city was, is because he moved the capital city. That was one of his strategies to show everybody that now he's a conquesting king. Don't think that I'm one of you. Don't think that I'm an inheriting king or whatever. No, now I'm a conquesting king. I am king by force. You guys are all my servants. I can do whatever I want with the treasury. I can make whatever decisions I want. One of the strategic moves he makes is moving the capital city to Shushan from where it was before in Bavel. And then what else did he do? He makes this big party. How does he have the funds to make a big party? Because he feels like making a big party. Guess what? That was part of his strategy too. He's showing them, I am making a large party. You can drink whatever you want. You can eat whatever you want. I'm inviting everybody. I'm having all this fancy stuff because the treasury is mine. And I can make whatever decisions I want with the treasury without having to ask anybody, exactly, right? Like we just said, I can make whatever decisions I want with the treasury. I can do whatever I want because I'm the conquering king. Right, and eventually he requires Vashti to come before him. He commands Vashti to come before him to put her down, right, and to say, "I am not king rightfully because I married somebody with ichus. I'm a king because I'm a conquering king. So the fact that I married her is irrelevant." Doesn't matter. She also, like everyone else, is enslaved, so to speak, right? Is a servant to my will. Kol ela hayu etos amukos lahoti magamaso ela poel lihishtayer aleihem. All these things that he's doing in his first psukim are showing us that the stage that we enter Megillas Esther in is a stage in which Ahasuerus is desperately and fanatically trying to establish his rulership as a despot over his kingdom, including all the Jews and everything that happens next. Okay, and again, he goes through the pieces of it. So we talked about why in Pasuk Beis, why we're talking, let me share my screen again. We talked about in Pasuk Beis, interestingly, one second, going through this Pesukim, right? Who Achashverosh? I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't found this somewhere, but I can't think of another example in which we see somebody introduced without Yichus. This almost never happens in Torah. To introduce a person without any Yichus. Even Haman, right? Haman ben Hamadasa. We know who he is. Mordechai, we know his Yichus. Esther, we know her Yichus. Right? Almost everybody. Again, I don't know a single other person in Torah. There might be. I'm not saying there isn't. I can't think offhand of somebody else that we get introduced to with nothing. He's a lone soldier. But that's who Ahasuerus was. Ahasuerus was a lone conquering soldier, not tied to his Yichus, not tied to his place of birth, right? Not tied to his rightful ascension to the throne, but coming in as a lone soldier conqueror and establishing himself as the most powerful person in the world. Pasuk Beis, right? He moves the seat of the king. He moves the capital to a city to establish it. This is where he wants his capital to be. So Malbim says, Hapartimi Masari Hamadinos were the people, his officials that existed beforehand, Lefanov, before he ascended to the kingship. And now he invites everybody else, but he invites them all as equals. And he's like, I'm not giving preferential treatment to the people who were there beforehand. It doesn't matter. Now I'm conqueror over everybody. Baharaso is Osher Kvod Malchuso. He shows his riches, right? His treasury, his Vaster Karktivaras Gedulaso. Look how great I am, right? Look, it's all mine. It's all mine. All this is mine. Right, he is not giving any preferential treatment. Everybody, as long as they're his vassals, they're all equal. Chur paras techelas, right? All of this great stuff that he's showing off, that he's saying are his. Hashko slave zahav, v'chelim mishchelim shonim, v'yena machuz kirav v'yal ha-melech. Vashtia, okay, edit up. And gam vashtia maka asta mishte nashim, she only gets, even though she, again, has more yichus than him, she only gets to do a party for the women. She's not invited to the main party with all the other, important nobles, etc. Beis malchus, beis ha-malchus. And she is in his palace. Right, so again, Malbim's point is, before we go into the Megillah, we have to start with an establishment of what is going on here. And what is going on here is that, again, Ahasuerus is like intensely strategizing of how to establish himself as the most powerful conquering king. Now, Malbim, as yet, I have not seen him explain like why this, like, you know, kind of the so what factor, as we call it. Listen, I don't think there needs to be a so what factor because it's Torah, so we're always allowed to learn Torah lishma, right? We can learn Torah, and Torah is always important, and it's always, important to learn, even if we can't draw a direct correlate to whatever it is that we're trying to draw a direct correlate to. On the other hand, I think it is like a fantastically important to understand the setup of the Megillah, because why? What does this teach us? So what? I mean, again, the so what could be like, okay, so this is important. This is what happened. But maybe there's a deeper lesson, and I think there is. Like, what do we care that this is what Ahasuerus is desperately trying to do, and that's how we launch the Megillah? Okay. Why might this be important? What could this teach us?
This teaches us anything, but I think it gives a lot of context to the story. Like, the story seems less esoteric if you put him into context of who he was. But, like, everything that transpired kind of makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I don't know if that's something to learn from it, but it does, like, make the storyline kind of flow better.
Yeah, Javi, I love what you're saying, because I think that, in a certain way, Ahasuerus is one of, like, the most ambiguous people that we know of in, like, Tanakh that we're familiar with. Because, like, you know, if you're looking at the illustrated kids' Megillahs, you'll see that either Ahasuerus is portrayed as like this scary, mean, evil, despot character, or he's portrayed as like some stupid, like fluffy, like going along with the wind of wherever it blows him kind of character. right? And like, we're not sure, like, is Ahasuerus like actively evil? Like, what role does he have here, right? He's like an interesting character kind of in the Megillah. So good, Javi. It gives us clarity of like what's going on. Russell Brown just wrote something in.
And does work with someone who conquered 127 countries.
Right.
Like someone, a king of 127 countries is not going to be stupid.
Exactly, right? So this is giving us like a much more of a robust understanding of who Ahasuerus was that shows us almost like the threat he posed to Bnei Israel. Right? Russell Brown writes, Lev Malachim Beyad Hashem, Visarim Beyad Hashem. The point of the Megillah is to show Hashem is watching us from the cracks and darkness. Good. So good. So Rachel Brown is that's where I was first thinking, right? I was thinking like, you know, obviously it looks like Ahasuerus is trying to establish himself as the most powerful person, right? That was this whole strategy for him. He's trying to show that he is the most powerful. That being said, right, like, ha ha on him. Hashem is the most powerful, right? And that's what the whole Megillah is about. It's about like, of course, Ahasuerus is like, we don't even know, you know, he being the most powerful character at the beginning, establishing himself as the most powerful guy around, is actually the one who's being tweaked around the whole time by Haman and Esther and Mordechai and obviously Hashem, like behind the scenes. So I was like, oh, it must be teaching us about human powerlessness vis-a-vis Hashem. That he felt like he was so powerful, but that we see that he's like, you know, the whole time he's getting pulled. He specifically is getting pulled in different directions by other people. And I was like, it's not, right? The Megillah is not trying to teach us about human powerlessness because there's a lot of human power in the Megillah. Where do we find human power in the Megillah? Which humans are powerful in the Megillah? You're like, I'm not sure if the answer is Mordechai or Haman. What'd you say, Ayala?
Esther and Mordechai.
Esther and Mordechai, right? The Megillah is not a story about human powerlessness. Dafka the opposite, right? There's tons of power. It's not that like, oh, Hashem is the one who's in power and no humans are powerful. That's not the point of the Megillah. The point of the Megillah is, of course, like Esther and Mordechai, right? Mordechai only doing the right thing, even with the pressure from Haman and the pressure from the Malchus and the pressure of the government and the pressure of all Bnei Israel to cave and do something that he knew is against Ratzon Hashem. He wouldn't do it. Right? That's powerful, and that has massive effects. Esther to sacrifice her life and go and possibly be killed by the king in order to save Bnei Israel, that was her taking power, and that had an effect. Right? Bnei Israel all fasting and davening in order to again, help and bolster and do tshuva for themselves and to help Esther in her accosting of the king, so to speak. Yeah, that is also powerful and also has an effect. Of course, the Megillah is full of people having a powerful effect on their reality. But that's the point here, right? The person who is setting himself up to be the most powerful character, and objectively, again, from what we see as humans, from what everyone saw at the time, and if we were able to be objective from what we would see now, the people who seem like they are the most powerful, they are, right? Ahasuerus objectively was the most powerful person in this story. He's a conquering king. He can do whatever he wants. He has the whole treasury. He's established himself. He's in charge of 127 Medinos. He is the most powerful person, objectively. But in terms of the spiritual world, of like how that story actually went down and what Cheshbonos Hashem took into account, he was a pawn for everybody else. And the people who seem like they're on the bottom of, you know, Yertle the Turtle stack, right? The people who seem like they're on the bottom, Mordechai and Esther and the Jews who are like the victims here and who are just trying to do their best and have no idea and have no power at all beyond just themselves and trying to do the right thing, they're the ones who have the power. And they're the ones who are the ones who change the circumstances and bring about a miracle that saves everybody and totally flip everything around. Right? And that's what it is, right? That's what we say the whole point of the Megillah is v'nahafochu. It's not just like a stam v'nahafochu, very nice. What we thought is one thing is actually another thing. It's the baseline spirituality is v'nahafochu. That's a definition of spirituality. The definition of spirituality is something that's counterintuitive, right? That there's a world beyond the world that we see that's counterintuitive, but if we tap into it, that's real. That's the actual power here. Ahasuerus was the one who looked so powerful, but the people who seem to be the victims of the story are the ones who were the power, who were the most powerful, and who Hashem gave the power into their hands to affect reality and not into his. So again, that's how Malbim says we start the Megillah, like Chavi said, both giving context to the people here and what is going on, but also already starting in the first 9 psukim to talk about that lesson of v'nahapochu. What looks like it's important, what looks, again, the first thing here is power, right? What looks to be powerful amongst humans is not what's powerful amongst humans. What is powerful amongst humans, and this is what we believe, are not the people who have the most power and the most riches and the most wealth and who are conquering and blah, 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 all those things that we conventionally define as power. What's powerful amongst humans are people who do Avodas Hashem and who try to do the right thing and who are at the bottom of the totem pole more often than not. But those people's actions, those people's choices, those people's sacrifices are what has an impact on reality, much more than the people who are in the positions of power. Power. Again, as the general spiritual principle of the Nahapochu, of counterintuitive. Spirituality has been counterintuitive. Questions?